Really excited today to welcome two fabulous guests to our podcast. Casey Levitt, who is the executive director of the Musculoskeletal Clinical Program at Intermountain Health, and Dr. Aaron Chamberlain, shoulder surgeon and senior medical director of the Musculoskeletal Clinical Program, also Intermountain Health. Aaron and Casey are dyad partners, and I've gotten to know them over the years. I've known Aaron for quite a while, and then got to meet Casey, and just learning about all the cool work that's going on Intermountain. So I appreciate both of you guys joining us and sharing all your expertise around specialty value-based care.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So I'll start with you, Casey. I'd love to hear a little bit about your role at Intermountain, how you kind of ended up in that role and found yourself in this field of specialty value-based care.
Yeah, sure. I think a lot of, like a lot of people in healthcare and listening to your previous podcast guests, it's been an interesting ride, right? 30 years in healthcare, but it started, my undergraduate degree was in exercise science. My parents were always really physically fit and active. My mom was a runner, my dad was a swimmer, and I just really had a passion for health and fitness and saw exercise as medicine. So after my undergrad, I got my first job out of school at an orthopedic surgery clinic in Salt Lake City, Utah, and met someone who would become a really wonderful friend and mentor over the next few decades, and that's Dr. Hugh West, an orthopedic surgeon. And while working in his practice, it was wonderful to have the experience working with patients. That's also one of the biggest challenges was working with patients, and I found I was really interested in the administrative and business side of healthcare, and went back to school to get my MBA while I was working with him. And he just let me conduct a number of experiments in his practice. And we would try different things with post-surgical rehab, and we would measure the costs of that and the outcome. And he let me apply queuing theory to his schedule and try to reduce wait times. And so I got to do a lot of really fun things while I was there. And after my MBA, I worked for three startup companies, and one of those, we negotiated capitation and subcapitation agreements between payers and networks of providers. So they might be multi-specialty or single specialty, and just got some really great experience there. And that kind of led to creating a network for a physician-owned health plan. And that really taught me, the importance of having the right providers on the team, having really good data and aligning incentives. And even though that was in the late 90s, it's really relevant now in the things that we're trying to do. So I worked in an academic health system for several years at the University of Utah, worked in payer contracting, and that was a really great education for me to understand the payer perspective. And I also learned that healthcare is just too transactional, in my opinion. After that, so Dr. Hugh West asked if I would come back to Intermountain. He had become the senior medical director of the Musculoskeletal Clinical Program and asked if I would return and be his dyad partner. So I did that, and through him, I met Dr. Kevin Bozick, who was your first guest on the podcast. And we visited Austin. We did his immersion program and went there. We took a team of about 30 Intermountain folks from different areas to see what they were doing in Austin. And I had the opportunity to meet Elizabeth Tiesberg, and I had been such a huge fan of hers, and her and Michael Porter's book, Redefining Healthcare. I kind of fangirled, like my palms were sweaty when I shook her hand. It was like she was a celebrity. But she told me about the master's program in healthcare transformation at UT Austin, and I immediately signed up for that and graduated in August 2023. So Dr. Hugh West retired just under a couple of years ago, but I was fortunate in that before he left, he recruited Dr. Aaron Chamberlain to be my dyad partner. So we are just continuing on this road.
So I have actually I jotted a couple of things down. I want to ask you about the earlier days around data and payer contracting. But yeah, I think Aaron, I'd be curious to see kind of where, because I actually don't remember where you fit on the Kevin Bozick educational value-based tree. But it's a good segue to kind of hear your story and how you end up in Intermountain. Obviously, I knew you before you went over there, but it'd be great to kind of hear how you ended up there.
Yeah. So as a faculty, as a junior faculty member at Washington University in St. Louis, I became more and more interested in not only the clinical research questions that we have, but also some of the kind of existential foundational questions we all have around healthcare delivery, the challenges we see, the problems, how do we solve those problems? And so I became a lot more interested in value-based care research and read up on Kevin Bozick, who was a former faculty at UCSF, where I was a medical student and connected up with him whenever I could to try to ask questions and pick his brain, and then did an MBA to try to learn better the business side of medicine and try to hopefully be more understanding, learn the language, be more impactful in our value-based care efforts and research. And explored all sorts of opportunities to do this type of work with WashU and BJC Healthcare in St. Louis, and had a great team there. And that's around the time that Hugh West reached out and said, "I think we have shared interests in value-based care, and I would love to have you join the team at Intermountain." So it was a great opportunity to join.
And I'll pose this kind of both of you all, but like I've never worked at Intermountain. I've heard of stories of Intermountain. I think Jeff Zavar was there, and I heard about the cement bowl mixing. We should probably get him on at some point too. But what is it about Intermountain that is special about value-based care? Is it a cultural thing, or are there pockets in Intermountain that are devoted to VBC, and everything else is still kind of a traditional fee for service? Like, what's that? I don't want to use the word vibe, but what is that, feeling at the system?
I mean, I feel like the origin story was really Dr. Brent James' work early on and his focus on, wanting to apply Edwards Deming's philosophies, in the automotive industry into healthcare and trying to reduce clinical variation and standardize practice. And he developed the clinical programs. And the clinical programs are really focused. They were originally very much focused on clinical quality improvement and looking at what is intended to be standard practice. How do we scale that across the system? How do we drive high adherence to standard practice? And I think that was, like I said, the origin of value-based care. But we had a primary care program, and then we also had several different specialty care programs. So it wasn't just focused on primary care only. It really involved all of the other clinical subspecialties as well. And I think it has evolved from there to look more upstream. And that kind of leads us to the term that Intermountain uses for value-based care is proactive care. And that is to try to remind us that the focus needs to be on moving upstream, not waiting until people are sick, not waiting till they show up in our ER, not waiting always until they have really advanced disease, but to try to get upstream. So I think it's evolved from not just following best practice, but being leaders in helping to develop what is best practice around proactive care and value-based care.
Like Aaron, from your end, so that I like that term, Casey, because it actually is fairly descriptive and synonymous with value-based care. From the orthopedic end, the specialist end, a lot of health systems that do value-based care, we still, as orthopods, are still factory workers. We still have to crank out those widgets of joints and spine surgeries. How is it at Intermountain? Is it still largely a fee-for-service mentality because we still need to drive revenue, or like how much of the specialty care is devoted to that mindset of value?
Yeah. So I guess first off, our book of business is about we're both fee for service and at risk with our health plan, as well as at risk contracts with other health plans. So we have a foot in both camps. That said, we have a culture, and I think Casey described it well. The history of where Intermountain has come from has really developed a culture for our specialists around how do we provide the highest quality care in a cost or a high value environment, or a value-based environment. So there's been a long history of data sharing around not only outcomes and how are we doing on complication rates, but also how do we track costs? Do we need to have this much variation as a group of specialists? And how do we all take ownership and some accountability of that in making our decisions?
So now, on one hand, when you recruit staff, clearly, if you select for those that have a value-based slant, if everybody was like both of you, you can permeate that culture. But most orthopods, we don't get that training in residency. I mean, I think back to the value-based course that PJ and I put together, and it was hard to get folks there from the orthopedic community. So then how do you actually change that culture? Are you guys just recruiting docs and specialists that are kind of more value-based mindset? Are you actually changing that mindset when they come in?
I think that's the first step. I think that when we recruit and we and all of our recruits meet and understand kind of the Intermountain way, number one, we won't pursue people if it becomes clear that they're not going to be team players and kind of catch that vision. But then the other way we'll kind of gain alignment with our docs is we do a lot of work to share data that they value, that's clinical data. And that we can leverage our system resources and assets to try to provide and share that data back with them. And then that data alone really creates a lot of understanding, awareness, and then some behavioral change. But Casey, what would you say about that kind of data? How do we gain alignment among our docs?
I mean, I would say it's not enough to just ask individual providers to be focused more on value-based care. Like, I don't think we will win by just asking surgeons to do less surgery. I want surgeons doing surgery. I want them busy in the OR. That's what they train to do, and I want them doing that really well. And that is a wonderful solution for a lot of our patients. But I believe that we have to take a system approach, and that does involve recruiting the right people and the people that are the right fit. But you know, the system is perfectly designed to get the results it gets. And so I think we need to design a system that doesn't send patients who are not indicated for surgery to surgeons. And I think we send patients who will benefit from a really great surgeon to really great surgeons. But I think it really, the answer lies in, yes, recruiting the right people, but also setting up the right system.
I was just going to add to that. I think the other thing to highlight is not only do we recruit, we have an employed group medical staff, and so we employed specialists, but a majority of our work is done with affiliated surgeons and specialists. So we can hire who we want to hire. We still have to work and figure out how to develop a system to gain alignment across a diverse group of surgeons who have variable degrees of alignment. I think that's where our work gets exciting, is how do we find ways to align surgeons and specialists with the outcomes for the patient. And do the best for the healthcare resources that we have.
So what you guys are saying is something that comes up a lot now that we've been dealing with as well, as we kind of meet all these health plans that we're working with. And the question I get all the time is, well, what is the orthopedic surgeon's role in value-based care? And what I've kind of learned over time, and you guys, it sounds like we're aligned on this, but I'd love to hear feedback, is that, and I think, Casey, this is what you just said too, is like the orthopedic surgeon's job is to take really good care of patients, and for those that need surgery, we're the ones to do it. And then both of you have used this word system multiple times. And what I think that we're not getting in value-based care as a society is that it's not the orthopedic surgeon's job or the specialist's job to do value-based care. It's the system's job to route the patient to the right spot. If somebody needs to lose weight and get better pain coping and better mental health, sending them to an orthopedic surgeon for their knee pain is really a bad idea. But the orthopedic surgeon doesn't have many tools besides a surgery, an injection, or a prescription for PT, right? And I think that it sounds like that's kind of what's being espoused there. And so when you have these private docs who are going to be fee-for-service mindset, and even the salary docs, the employed docs who may have a little bit different taste, the whole point is that the patient seeing them is being evaluated for surgery, not for evaluate. It's not the surgeon's job to do that. So is that kind of in line with what you guys are saying and trying to do at the service line level?
Yeah, so it's exactly kind of our primary focus is how do we, you know, if we look at the body of work in MSK care, a majority of it is not surgical typically, right? And I think evidence bears that out. And so why is the surgeon the first person the patient thinks of to call, or a referring doc to say, you've got knee pain, you need to go see the knee surgeon, when most knee pain doesn't need surgery? And so, and our surgeons, you know, we've had this discussion with them, and we've, you know, a lot of our surgeons get that vision to say, hey, it's not worth the patient's time to come and see me and have a conversation around why you don't need surgery. Additionally, it's probably not worth the patient's time to waste that time to be told, hey, what you really need to do is go lose weight and let's get you looped in with nutrition and pay another copay to do that. And then beyond that, this it doesn't help the system either to say, let's just by default focus everything around the surgeon. For with all best intent, I think, us as surgeons see, we're the hammer and we see nails. We're going to operate and we're going to try to help people. And my tool is a surgery, which is a very expensive endeavor compared to many other things. And so what we're trying to take is the surgeon away from the being the center point of MSK services and needs, put the patient at the center point and surround the patient with appropriate services and specialists based on what they need, rather than just have this default path to the surgeon at the beginning.
This came up. So Kelton Burbank talked about his IPU, and I know Aaron, in case you know Kelton, and the what it comes down to is that, like you just mentioned, getting the patient to the right spot. And we're at his organization, they identified the risk-bearing patients and funneled them into consideration for the IPU, and were able to get them there. So if you look at every big health system in the country, there's a value-based component, even if it's their own self-insured employees. They usually have an ACO, partnership with health plans. There are people they're at full financial risk for, or some sort of financial risk for. And so that means every health system in the country would benefit from an approach like you guys are saying. So I'll turn this to you, Casey. What are you all doing, or what advice do you have for other health systems to help that triage? Because it's not easy, right? Because you got to identify the right patient, and you got to actually have the services to offer them, and then you got to route them there. So what are you all doing or working on in progress to attack that? And what should all these health systems do that need to solve this problem?
Yeah, a lot of the way I think about it, because I get this a lot. Like, everyone understands, I think, value-based care in concept, because it's a really simple, elegant concept. You know, the greatest outcomes for the dollar spent. But it's really, you can understand the concept and still not know where to start and not know what to do to implement. And so I think about it in terms of four work streams. The first is patient research and human-centered design. I think we do not spend enough time with patients who are experiencing musculoskeletal conditions to understand five things. And that is, what are the outcomes that matter to patients? What are their unmet needs? What are the gaps in care they're experiencing? What are the barriers that they're experiencing? And finally, what's working really well for them? And then we take that information that we learn from talking to patients, and not in focus groups, but really talking to them and understanding what is it like to live, for example, with knee osteoarthritis. And then we design a system that delivers the outcomes that they're looking for. So that's the first work stream, patient research and human-centered design. The second is value measurement. You need to set up metrics differently. So, are you capturing patient-reported outcomes? And in orthopedics, those are the outcomes. Patient-reported outcomes are what matter to patients. Yes, it's great that we avoid harm and we don't hurt people. It's great that we develop a really good, that we have a good experience, but we've got to measure the outcomes from the patient's perspective. And then we also have to measure all of our costs. So we have to know, what does it cost us to deliver the care, and what does it cost the payer, the employer, and the patient to receive that care? So your value metrics are number two. Number three is the payment models and benefit design. We can change the healthcare delivery process, but if we get paid the exact same way, which is every time you perform a service, you get paid, we can't implement it and have it be financially viable. So we have to work with payers and employers to change the payment model and set up benefits to create an incentive for patients to go this route. Then finally, just implement and scale. You've got to do some pilots, you got to figure out what works, and then scale it more broadly. But when you're taking that approach, it really helps design features like virtual care, using lower cost caregivers, physical therapy assistants, things like group physical therapy. I think we really underutilize group physical therapy, and there's a lot that patients get out of being with other people that share that same condition. We don't do a lot of those things, health coaching, because we can't submit a claim and get paid for it, so we don't do it. But that's what I would tell a health system, is follow those four work streams.
So AI motion
AI
capture is
motion
not
capture is
the
not
Not the outcome we need.
Not the outcome
Is
we
that what
need.
I'm hearing?
Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, or a beautiful X-ray, right? Or the avoidance of an embolism.
Aaron, on your end, same question to you. Kind of, most health systems are, I understand there's all kinds of priorities, but at the same time, there's this kind of very known concern that MSK costs are high and they keep going higher. And unlike cardiometabolic or cancer, MSK costs are really modifiable, right? If you go to a better surgeon than another one, like you'll probably have a less chance of an unnecessary surgery. Or if you give good pain coping skills, you won't end up in the ER. So what from the specialty side, what's going on that you guys are planning? And I understand probably a lot of things are underway. Like how are you getting that cadre of services that can steer patients to non-operative services as an alternative to seeing us in the office for their 3 days of shoulder pain?
Yeah, so this is key, and this is where the system and leveraging the system alignment and organization is kind of where we really focus. But what we're working on is leveraging not just our specialty care services, but our specialty care adjacent physical therapy, rehab services, nutrition services. We have a couple of places that are in our enterprise where many of those things are co-located, where we have, specialty care clinics right next to physical therapy clinics, and we're building relationships and fostering that team dynamic of how do we work together and develop that. Upstream from that, we work with our primary care network, which we have, we have our own primary care network and navigation system where we can place clinically informed people, ATCs, nurses, et cetera, on, upstream in the triage process, where with a few questions, we can develop an algorithm around how do we, clinically, where's the patient at? And then based on that information, we can get a clinically informed decision on where to triage and place that patient in that care continuum. And then we can control that navigation from upstream all the way into our specialty care clinics. But the key element kind of in the brick and mortar area is how do we work as a team? How do we have cross specialties in the team where physical therapy might be the first person of the team that sees the patient, and then they work with them and the surgeon can come in and work as necessary. Casey mentioned virtual care, and that's another tool that we feel strongly should be, is available and should be available to our patients where upstream, if we need a little more information or can do a remote assessment, patients may want to be seen remotely. We may be able to save them a trip into a brick and mortar site and perform not only diagnostic, assessment, but some physical assessment and treatment as well. And so trying to deliver appropriate, get them in front of the right provider at the right time in the right setting as efficiently as we can is kind of where we're focusing. But it really takes work to leverage all the assets we have and Intermountain's a vertically integrated system. So we have a lot of those assets in-house. And it can be hard, if depending on the health system that you might be practicing in, some of those assets may be missing. I would say, understand your surroundings, understand what you have, and try to maximize and move in that direction as best you can.
So if I'm a patient, or if I'm a patient that has Select Health, one of the Select Health plans that you guys are at full risk for, how do you know that I'm in that risk-bearing group? And how do you guys triage someone like me to get those services that are not necessarily billable, like a group PT or maybe a health coaching, whatever, that can help? And even if it's not being done now, how would it work, in a type of setting like that for that triage?
I mean, we do have a flag in our electronic medical record that is visible to all providers that indicates this is a patient for whom our system is financially at risk. So they are aware. And that was, that's been really helpful for like our Medicare bundle programs so that physicians actually know, okay, we've, this is going to be on the report. We've got to just be really conscientious about how we maximize the healthcare dollar for this patient. And then, beyond that, we're working really closely. That's one of the really wonderful things about having a payer as part of our system is we partner with them to, if we have a program that, we're trying to reduce their MSK spend for their patient population, we meet with them and they work with us to structure benefits accordingly. So they, we've talked with them about waiving, group therapy expenses adding that to, their equivalent of the Silver Sneakers program for Medicare, and they're very open to doing those kinds of things. Another example is office-based hand surgery. So we were able to work with Select Health because it saves them as a payer $3,500 to $4,000 per patient when we pull them out of the hospital outpatient department and move them into the office setting for carpal tunnel surgery, because they're saving so much money, but the surgeon is assuming a much higher burden. They agreed to increase the compensation to surgeons when it's done in the office. And so that's another way that we can partner with them to help deliver on this kind of care.
The site of service that you bring up, super important. And I think that, we've kind of dived into this in some videos. And if you look at risk sharing, right, whether, from our end, we're a digital solution, right? So level one risk sharing is we take risk on our clinical outcomes. Level two is on an individual basis. So if the members we engaged, did we make them healthier or not, and with cost savings? Then level three is a population-based risk sharing. And that population-based requires a couple things. It requires the ability to treat the patient or the member at best to get that value-based care. So whether it's coaching, group therapy, virtual, et cetera, but it also requires a tight integration with utilization management, which is not in the scope of what we're talking about today. But it also requires site of service, right? So because if a patient's getting a surgery in an office or an ASC, it's cheaper than an HOPD or an inpatient setting. Now, this, of course, is at direct odds with the fee-for-service revenue system, which is going to, as a hospital system, you want to have more inpatient or more HOPD. So how does Intermountain straddle that? Because it is a very difficult thing to have kind of the plan benefiting from cheaper site of service, but the system benefiting for a more expensive site of service when they own that plan. So how are you guys handling it, or how should it be handled?
Well, we won't sugarcoat it. It's not easy, and we don't have it figured out. Intermountain is historically and still is primarily a hospital company. And so that fee for service, do more stuff in the hospital, there's still that part of our company that exists. The benefit we have is that with our health plan and with our executive, we have pretty very strong executive leadership that understands the need for solving these broader healthcare problems. And we view part of our mission is to be a model health system in that. And so we have, pretty strong, from a board level all the way down through our C-suite, a kind of a dictum to say we need to figure this out and understand value-based care and proactive care. So it does take strong leadership. Even then, there's tension, and so we've been working a lot around how do we align financial incentives in the different verticals of healthcare. The hospitals that want have certain incentives. Medical group physicians have different incentives. The health plan often has countering incentives, and so we find that it's a lot of work, but rewarding work to get all those stakeholders in the same room to try to understand how do we work through those different things. But we do have opportunities to find alignment where we can say, hey, let's work on developing clinical care delivery models that save the health plan money. And in turn, that can be shared with providers doing the hard work to do that. And altogether, as a health system, we can create a net-net financial statement that we understand when one segment, when the health plan does better, the whole system should do better. In the end, the patient should be doing better, and we should incentivize ourselves for that.
Perfect segue to my next question, because on those innovative care delivery programs, let's say it's a multidisciplinary program, an IPU, virtual care, group care. There's a common belief that the orthopedic surgeons at large, not just at Intermountain, just everywhere, do not want their surgical volume stripped away from them. And I feel like that's a very much of a gross oversimplification. I'm sure some surgeons on one end of the spectrum want to do as much surgery as possible, even when not indicated. But there's a big misconception from health plans that we as specialists would be very angry with initiatives that take away our volume. How do you respond to that? And what is your experience with, for both of you, the surgeons you've interacted with? Are they generally like mad that there's value-based programs in effect, or are they in favor of those things? And how do you reconcile the volume loss if there is one?
Well, I've just worked with surgeons for so long. I don't know any orthopedic surgeons who really enjoy having a conversation with a patient who walks in and the surgeon knows right away this is not a surgical problem. You know, trying to talk about rehab and conservative care, I think they embrace any sort of program that only puts appropriate patients into their office that are surgical candidates. That has been my experience, Aaron.
Yeah, I think the reaction you described, Eric, is common. Most surgeons will bristle at the idea of saying, "Wait, why am I want to be the front door. I want to decide who comes and sees me in clinic. I want to basically decide who needs surgery and who doesn't. And if you tell me I need to do less surgery, that makes me very uncomfortable. That's my livelihood." The way I think we get around it, number one, there's a systematic portion of this, which is if you have more surgeons per capita in a population, you're going to see a lot more surgery. And those surgeons view themselves as fighting for their sliver of that pie in that market. To the extent we can try to contain that or organize that and say, hey, rather when we want to grow as a system, let's grow with non-surgical, type, providers for the MSK space, and then we can deliver our surgeons surgically appropriately indicated cases. Their time is better, is more valuable to them, or it's more efficient for them to use their time that way. And we feel that outcomes are going to be better too. If we, in an ideal state, if we had surgeons just doing appropriately indicated surgery all day, every day, that's maximum utilization, maximum efficiency. But what we don't want to have is, hiring more surgeons at various hospitals just to cover call schedules. And then we overpopulate and saturate the community with surgeons. And then those surgeons are fighting over volumes to make, to make ends meet or to make their financial goals. And then you see a lot of increase in utilization. So I think there's a systemic approach, as far as, surgeons per capita. But we really want to focus on the messaging to our surgeons is we want you to operate. We want you to operate a lot on appropriately indicated patients. So that's what we're working to organize upstream from the surgeon.
Do you think, Aaron, that it's true that most orthopedic surgeons do not want value-based non-operative programs to exist in the ecosystem?
I don't know. I think it's mixed. I think, I don't know, there's probably some geographic preferences there as far as what response you might get, maybe generational as well. I think most of my partners and kind of my era of practice, we enjoy working as a team with physical therapists, having robust non-operative care pathways. I find that as a huge asset, because I, like Casey said, I don't want to spend most of my time reviewing again and again non-surgical things that I'm not the expert to talk about, right? So I love having that. But I think there would be a mix of surgeons who would say, yeah, I would rather see everything and then be the filter on what comes through to the OR.
Where I hear the most concerns is when it comes to just concerns for the patient, not concerns about themselves. The fears I hear are they're worried it's going to be like a gatekeeper type system and that we will err on the side of not referring patients for surgery who need surgery and that we're going to harm patients. So from what I see, it just comes from, you know, a genuine interest in patients. And when that happens, they say, I want to be a part of how decisions are made to determine whether a patient needs surgery or not. I just want to be a part of that. I don't need to see every patient. I just want to help inform which patients would benefit from surgery.
I think that's a very good way to consider it. And I think the take home is that even the surgeons that want to be part of that non-operative journey, they're doing it to help quarterback the care. They're not doing it to say that we want to block the care. And I think that that message is so important for our health plan colleagues because you have health plans that are saying we don't want to make the orthopedic surgeons mad by doing these kind of innovative programs, but we do utilization management, right? So it's like, you can't kind of speak out of both sides of your mouth, but I think what I'm hearing from both of you is that even the ones that want to see the patients that need non-operative care, they're doing it to quarterback it and to ensure they have access. And those that don't want there to be an abundance of these non-operative programs because you're right, Aaron, like we look at our yield, right? We don't, then I think it's shocking. I think most people will be shocked about how few patients we operate on in a clinic when that we indicate for surgery. The vast majority are people seeing us. I look at my schedule next week and someone's seeing me with like a totally condition I don't take care of, and they're coming to see me just so they can get a physical therapy prescription. that doesn't make any sense, like at all, right? So we don't want to see people that don't need to see us, as long as they have a place to go. Now, if we need to quarterback that care and get them, fine, we'll see that. But I think by and large, I think health plans really need to understand that, like, we're happy as specialists to have all these programs because then the ones that see us are ready and optimized for it. Is that a safe simplification or summary?
Yeah, I think as long
Yeah.
as the specialist feels that there's, clinically informed, that they, like Casey said, if they have input into that, and and we're all on the same page on what's best practice, that's it. I think it's a much easier conversation.
Last week, I went to the Becker's conference in Chicago, and one theme kept coming up was payer-provider partnerships. Now, Henry Ford, Intermountain, Payvider, we have health plans. It's a very different opportunity than standalone provider groups and plans. How are you all interfacing from the specialty side with health plan leadership, or how do you want to be if it hasn't happened yet?
We've talked a little bit about our relationship with Select Health, right? Our own health plans. So we have a very familiar relationship with them. Casey and I meet often with the medical director of the health plan. We've met with the CMO, value officer, and we review their policies with them and for them, and make sure that they're aligned with best practice and evidence, et cetera. So we have a very familiar relationship with them. And even then, it's still work to try to be creative in some of these payer provider relationships on, what's appropriate, criteria for surgery. How do we make sure our utilization is appropriate as a population across their book of business? And it's a very heavy data lift, even with them. So when we work on, as we have been working on, to get toward a situation more of a subcapitated, condition-based bundles, all the different ways you can try to fund a value-based or proactive care initiative, Select Health for us is our natural partner to start with. That said, we have found that even other health plans outside of Select Health are very interested in some types of initiatives. And Casey mentioned earlier our hand, site of service. We've focused on shifting site of service to the clinic when appropriate. But in addition to that, we went to the health plans and said, let's negotiate for a better, provider reimbursement for those providers who are doing the work to move those cases. And largely, many health plans are interested in doing that. Now, that's a small, kind of a smaller part of the book of business. There's a general, concern or a discomfort on the financial side of things, is if you start moving things around financially, how does that flow? How does that program work out? We've been able to provide at least a roadmap in some of those areas where we hope that now other, other providers or payers who are considering a type of relationship like that can look at our kind of experience in our book of business and how that's gone for us from both a quality and financial standpoint.
See, from your aspect
From your
on the
aspect on the
administrative business side,
administrative
right?
business
So
side.
how do your peers coming in kind of get the knowledge base? Like the stuff that we're all talking about in this call right now, a lot of nuanced acronyms, nuanced programs, even the words like, a subcapitated model. There's a lot to digest there. How do leaders like yourself on the business and administrative side get caught up to speed? Like practically, like what would you say if I came to you and said, look, I am a business diet leader for orthopedic service line and I want to do value-based care, but I have no idea where to start because I'm coming from primary care, for example, and I haven't done specialty care. How do your colleagues and peers get up to speed and then
And
get that acumen to start
get
making a
that
real
acumen to
contribution?
make it. I do get asked this a lot, and that really was the impetus for why I decided to get, I was 50 years old. I wasn't thinking about getting another master's degree, but our organization had declared proactive care one of their top two strategic initiatives, and I felt like I really need to know what I'm doing. I need to know what I'm talking about. I need to understand the language. I need to talk with people internationally because there is so much great experience in other countries with these types of models than in the US. And so I did get my master's, but that's kind of cost prohibitive or really challenging for a lot of people. So I usually tell people, read Michael Porter and Elizabeth Teichberg's book, Redefining Healthcare. It came out in 2006, but it is still so relevant. And then, I don't have any financial ties, but a lot of the faculty at UT Austin have put together a value-based care certification program through ICHOM, the International Consortium for Health Outcomes Measurement, much cheaper than a master's degree, but a really excellent education. We've had one of our providers is going through it now, but I think there are some programs out there. That one is really cost-effective. Again, there's so much that you can read. There's a lot of material. I think the work that you're doing, you have white papers, you have a lot of information about what you've been doing. I've used a lot of your materials and shared them with people as well.
And I will take the time. There's a we'll make the plug. There is a book that I think Aaron, you, I know Casey, you're part of a chap, a textbook that I get zero royalties from. But yes, there are books out there that you can get. And if anyone's listening, happy to help guide them. So I think we could go on for a while on a lot of these topics, and I know we're only scratching the surface, and I hope we can do this again, but I want to also be mindful that, like, I've stolen an hour from you guys, so I want to be respectful of it. But one question I like to ask everybody is, what are you most proud of to date in your career and most excited of for the next steps forward? So I'll start with you, Casey, on that one first, then go to Aaron.
Yeah, having listened to your podcast, I knew we would get this question. But I think that I'm most proud of, I've been back at Intermountain just over 9 years. And I think a couple of things I'm really proud of. Some more generally, I think one of the things I'm really proud of is raising the awareness of cost in healthcare. When I started, I think all of our clinicians were really focused on my job is just clinical. My job is only clinical and delivering the best clinical outcome. And, there are many ways to cause harm to people. And I think you can cause financial harm if you're not careful. And I think we need to be very cognizant of, our patients who are paying more and more and more of the healthcare dollar. And we've got to be really careful. And so one of the best days I remember, I used to always sit in our meetings that we have with our surgeons. We meet with a different group of subspecialists every morning at 6:30 in the morning. And one day, someone was talking about a new product that they wanted to put on contract, one of our surgeons, and someone said, "Well, how much does it cost?" And I was like, that is the first time that I haven't had to ask that question, and they asked it themselves. And so I'm really proud of that. And then, the last thing I just want, I'm really proud of the work we did around opioid prescribing. We don't talk about it quite as much anymore, but, my husband experienced opioid addiction and died by suicide about 10 years ago or about 15 years ago. And we had three kids. And it was just really rewarding working with our surgeons, leveraging data. Meeting with them, talking with them, gathering data from patients, and we decreased our prescribing by over 50%. And we found really novel, wonderful ways to manage pain. So it wasn't just like patients were suffering. But I think when we bring providers to the table and we show them data and we engage them in conversations, we have done that at Intermountain. And I'm really proud of that and the things that we've been able to do with that.
Super hard. Sorry to hear about that, but clearly turning it into a motivation to kind of at least help others. So very much appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you.
Aaron, how about
Yeah,
you?
I think Eric, for me, I'm looking back at, since I've really gotten into this work, I'm really proud of this team that we work with and the organization we work with. I'm proud of the fact that Intermountain is a very principled organization and willing to act outside of its financial interests when it makes the most sense for the patient. Like I mentioned before, we have very strong leadership around that, around and aspirations to be a model health system. And it's not a straight line. It's a crooked road, and it can be difficult. And I think I'm really proud of the team and our willingness to kind of check our what we're used to at the door and say, this is the way we've always done things. And we recognize that moving forward, we can't do things the way we've always done it. And we're going to work together to try to solve big problems. And this team that we work with together is really expert in, not only just these kind of problem solving in general, but healthcare problem solving, understanding the problem and understanding how we need to work together to do it. we're a very collaborative organization, and so we work as teams. Nothing's really done on our own, and so really proud of the work that our clinical program does in collaborating with finance, with health plans, with hospitals, and our affiliate specialty providers as well. So we spent a lot of time on that. Really proud of the work we've done, but most excited about what's coming because of the team. Looking ahead, I have optimism that we're going to figure this out, and we're going to make some headway in the specialty care space with value-based care and proactive care. We're going to be able to hopefully then pave some path forward for others to join us on the path, where right now it may not look clear for other types of organizations on how they can make this happen, but we hope that we can help blaze that trail a little bit and bring others along with us.
As you said, if Intermountain's number one or two priority is proactive care, you're going to get there. And I think I would challenge any health system that wants to do value-based care. If it's not listed as a priority, then I don't think it's going to happen. Thank you so much to you both. And I look forward to kind of continued collaboration and kind of seeing you on the circuit. And I really appreciate you guys taking the time.